Welcome, everyone. And that song's a little bittersweet. That's probably why it's bittersweet, because that's in the title of it. So welcome, everyone, to Street and Curb. I'm your host, Steve Carvelli. Join me every Wednesday, 5 p.m. on your drive home. If you're home making dinner, if you're at school, if you're goofing off at work, you know, tune in for the next half hour. I think it'll be quite interesting. People ask me, what does Street and Curb really do? Well, Street and Curb, we're not in the gutter, although the Street and Curb does have a connection to the gutter, but it's basically theory, commentary, and action plans for the country. It's a pragmatic approach to our current issues and problems, but most importantly, the theme of the show is going to be a lot on the silent majority. And we're going to talk a lot about that in the upcoming weeks, what it is, how it can be effective in moving our country forward instead of the stalemate that we're at. So there's a lot to talk about, and we have a very contentious election coming up this year. We have a lot of pressure points on how we interact with people, a lot of protests. So hopefully we're going to look at things with a very pragmatic approach. And we're going to start as soon as we take this quick break, and we'll start on Street and Curb.
Serving my country required sacrifice. Sacrifice that changed my life forever. I remember the day I came home. Because of my injuries, this house wasn't right for me anymore. I remember the narrow doorways, the small bathrooms, the shelves out of reach when in my wheelchair. Every day was full of obstacles. I felt trapped. I remember a better day. The day my family received a specially adapted custom home from Homes for Our Troops. That day changed everything. Now we have a safe and accessible home to enjoy the freedom I fought for. This place, our home, is exactly what we needed to rebuild our lives.
Homes for Our Troops builds and donates specially adapted custom homes nationwide for severely injured post 9/11 veterans and enables them to rebuild their lives. Join our mission at hfotusa.org.
When a child is diagnosed with cancer, the last thing parents should have to worry about is how to pay for it. This is a St. Jude moment.
Imani wouldn't be here if it wasn't for St. Jude, and I can't imagine a better place to be.
You know, it's a cliche thing to say, but I feel like my faith in humanity has been restored. The second we arrived here, we had food, housing, transportation, treatment, you name it, it was taken care of by St. Jude Children's Research Hospital. There was not a single other care in the world except for Imani, because St. Jude made that happen. The best way I can really describe it is this is heaven on earth. To the people who donate to St. Jude, you know, I just want them to know that I don't think anyone in this world or anything in this world has given me a greater gift. We came as two desperate parents, and they saved our daughter's life.
Finding cures, saving children. Learn more at stjude.org.
Welcome back, everyone, to Street and Curb. I'm your host, Steve Carvelli. As I said earlier, 5 o'clock on Wednesdays is your start time for our show here for the next half hour. Again, today, what we're going to talk about is really what the silent majority is. And if you think about what's happening in the world today, what's our primary issue? Well, believe it or not, the primary issue in this country is what the vocal minority has been screaming about. It just seems no matter what avenue we go down or what campus we visit or what political party meeting we go to or what even PTA meeting we go to, there's always a vocal minority that seems to articulate their position by a screaming method that seems to drown out the more silent majority who do not speak. Now, it's interesting that we have a vocal minority in each political party. We have the Democrat and Republican Party. Both have their wings that are more radical than the moderates in the middle. So both parties have it. But if you look at everything, people never really identify what the silent majority is. And I guess most people think of a silent majority as primarily moderate, fiscally conservative, socially center or just left of center on social issues. But we're going to clarify this all later to maybe think that maybe that definition needs to be redefined and revisited. So there are some definitions that, contrary to some opinions in political parties, it's not a group of degenerates or Bible-toting or Bible-selling MAGA sycophants or people who live in rural America, or it's not union card-holding groupthinkers from urban areas. So depending on the party that you belong to or the party that persuades you, you may have opinions of the silent majority of that. So I want to go over what is the silent majority. Actually, the term actually comes from Roman times, and it's actually a euphemism for the dead, because there are more people over time that have died than are living right now. It's an unfortunate fact, but I guess all the dead are the majority, and they're silent because they are dead. But if we race up to the modern era, actually it comes into vogue around Nixon's time. Nixon really kind of galvanized these silent majority to a voting bloc, and they were generally blue-collar, white, apolitical, suburban, middle-class voters who otherwise are going to vote, but they were very dissatisfied with the Vietnam War. But they were not on the campuses complaining about it. They were not protesting about it. They were not creating violence over it. So Nixon kind of popularized the term and galvanized it into a voting bloc. So that's where the silent majority really has come into vogue today. So today, the silent majority is basically a bloc of voters who do not express an opinion publicly. They're not on the editorial pages. They're not on CNN. They're not the guest speaker on a political talk show or a podcast. This is a silent majority who basically goes about their stuff, maybe political, but apolitical in how they discuss it. So I guess it's perhaps a marginalized, underrepresented by the current political system. And it's also a majority that is silenced continuously by a screaming vocal minority and probably a fawning press that goes into that. So why does this majority remain silent? I had an interesting conversation with an entrepreneur in Virginia the other day. He ran several businesses. He ran a plumbing company. He's a comedian. He was on the Comedy Channel. He has a business in Japan. And we were talking about the political voices in this country. And one of the things he said is that the silent majority does not speak because they are in the business of earning a living and doing day-to-day activities, that they have a full day of making a paycheck, going home, making sure the kids go to school, making sure the kids go after school events. If they're in rural America, they're doing the farming. If they're in industrial America, they're actually putting the cars together. And they have a full day. And these people are generally, because of work commitments, family commitments, even pet commitments, he mentioned, you know, taking their dog to the veterinarian in the afternoon, that this is the electorate that really is not public with their political opinions, except that they talk about it at the dinner table and so forth. So he was saying that the silent majority is indeed silent because they are the ones actually doing the work in this country. And that's a very good point that he makes, because I kind of agree with that the silent majority is the working class, but this is the working class who's not complaining about a handout, who is not protesting, who doesn't have the funds to protest and not have the money to back it up. So you get the point that the silent majority is busy with life's commitments and basically earning a living and contributing to the GNP. So this is the working class that we're going to talk to about this show and in subsequent shows, and how to get the silent majority a little less silent and a little less focused on the majority. Politically, I do believe that the people who do work for a living and go about their day doing day-to-day are fiscally conservative because, again, I think most Americans in their day-to-day activity are responsible for their bills. They do not overspend. They do not deficit spend. And if they do, it's a problem, and they try to correct it. And if they do find themselves into a deficit, it's because of macro circumstances or circumstances beyond their control, losing a job, death in the family. So I think most Americans do have a fiscal conservative approach. Unlike this country in which the deficit is growing to an astronomical amount, a predicted doomsday amount of the deficit that's going to be reached within 1 to 2 years, and that's going to be almost impossible to pay off. On the social side, I think this demographic is moderate, center, and maybe a little left of center on social issues. Now, I don't want to get into the social issue, magnification of the silent majority, because of course that brings a lot of flashpoints to people, and people don't like to hear about all that. So we're going to try to avoid that a little bit and leave that up to the individual. We want to talk about the silent majority as a block of voters that have been pretty much silenced on a lot of issues. And that's what really Street and Curb is about. It's Street and Curb is to give the voice to the common voter, give a voice to the silent majority, give a voice to the person who's generally unable to get a voice heard, not get a podcast, not become a guest on CNN. Because, of course, you know, when you look at today's media, they always, you know, trounce about the same people talking about the same things, and apparently they act as the spokespeople for America. And I don't believe that is the case. So we're going to come kind of full circle and generally get the silent majority as a vocal and generally and to be able to put down the screaming minority. Now, it's interesting that if you consider what's a screaming minority today, it has many media and public outlets. And I'm going to take one an example, and that is the college protests that started at Columbia and had kind of spread throughout every campus as a kind of a copycat complaint. So from Columbia to USC, from coast to coast, both coasts and every college in between that had some kind of tent going up protesting our support of Israel and Israel's involvement in Gaza. So the protesters are always the darlings of the media. They had every media showed outlets of protesters interviewing them and not having any critical analysis of their position. It was always, you know, we want the college to divest from Israeli investments. And it's really interesting if you think about it, but the critical thought would be that you are generally the guest of the college for 4 years. So your $90,000, if you're going to Columbia, goes towards tuition, it goes towards dorms, it goes towards books. But somehow the protesters feel that they have extended that 4 years so they can dictate investment policy for the college. But not one media position, not one interview ever brought that up, that they are basically renting the campus for 4 years. And, you know, as a tenant or as a renter of the campus, do they have the rights to dictate a longer-term policy for the university? And I've never understood why that's never come up. So the media has been overly broad in accommodating these type of vocal minorities, and it's been very difficult to actually get critical thinking going on with them. Another aspect of this that I really find is appalling is about free speech. And of course, every university professor who went in with the campus group and every media talks about free speech. Free speech is indeed a right. However, the exercise of such speech cannot infringe on others' exercise of rights, whether it be free speech or anything else. You cannot call for harm and destruction or disparage or libel anybody. For instance, the exercise of free speech cannot prevent another from attending class, cannot prevent another from walking around campus unhindered, from not prevent anyone from walking unharassed down the street. The exercise of freedom of speech and exercise of our constitutional rights is guaranteed by the Constitution. However, we cannot infringe upon another person's exercise of their rights by us exercising our rights. And this is really a fundamental premise that seems to get mentioned on the sidelight a little bit. It doesn't really get into any critical thinking with the media, but we are not allowed to stop someone from attending class because we're exercising our rights. And this is something that really bothers me with the vocal minority and people who protest, because it's not in the U.S. Constitution that guarantees them that, and it's not being really analyzed by the media by someone asking that type of question. It's generally a note that's dismissed by mainstream media because they're talking about the rights of a few of a vocal minority and how that vocal minority can really exercise their free speech and do something to do that. So again, you know, I'm going to go more into the issues about the campus protests, how they impact us. But it's really talking about the vocal minority and how they have the media totally fawning over them. Every night you would see CNN, they're on every campus looking at tents in a lawn. So, we're going to come back in a second. We're going to talk a little bit about more of the hypocrisies that have gone into some of these things and then how we as a silent majority can really plan a path of action to go forward. So we're going to take a quick break. We're going to be right back.
On the battlefield, there's a saying America's military men and women live by. Never leave a fallen warrior behind, ever. Off the battlefield, Wounded Warrior Project operates with the same goal. We leave no warrior behind. Wounded Warrior Project is a nonprofit organization created to help our men and women returning home with the scars of war. Whether those scars are physical or mental, we're here to make sure that they heal. And whether it's helping those with post-traumatic stress disorder live a normal life again, or giving much-needed support to injured warriors and veterans hospitals, because no one deserves our help more than the men and women who risk their lives to keep us safe. Wounded Warrior Project. We never leave a fallen warrior behind. Ever. Learn more about what we do at woundedwarriorproject.org.
My name is Alana. I was 6 years old and I got diagnosed with cancer. I come to St. Jude for treatment.
After her last treatment on December the 4th, I was just kind of having a conversation with her, letting her know, Alana, you did awesome. I mean, so proud of you. Like, there, you fought, you accepted whatever was happening, you went with it. And her words to me were, Mommy, thank you so much for helping me get through this. She said, I could not have done this without you. This was very hard. And I couldn't even hold my tears because when I think about it, I would not have been able to get through this without St. Jude. And so once we became part of the St. Jude family, everything was okay. Thank you, St. Jude, for helping me get her through this because I wouldn't have been able to do it without them.
St. Jude Children's Research Hospital, finding cures, saving children. Learn more at stjude.org.
Welcome back to the symphony we call Street and Curb, and today we're talking about the silent majority. One of the things I wanted to bring up with the college protests that I kind of alluded to in the last segment is the hypocrisy that, I don't know if I want to call it a bias, but I think I'm more called of as a hypocrisy. And one example is this. In the Floyd era, when we had all the reawakening about race relations, there was a concept called cultural appropriation, which basically meant that certain types of people couldn't wear their hair in certain ways because that comes kind of appropriated to a certain culture or race. However, if we look at what's happening now, that everyone is wearing the headbands and the head scarves called kufrisas, I may be saying that wrong, but there's been a question whether that's cultural appropriation. And the answer has been, because that is a symbol of the Palestinian cause, they expanded the use of it. It used to be worn by Bedouins that would identify them in the desert about, you know, what their tribe was and where they were going and what they did. Now it's a symbol of the Palestinian cause, so it is not cultural appropriation. It is basically you're sympathetic for the cause. And I have a little bit of an issue with that because you don't redefine clothing articles to fit the narrative. So in other words, if it is cultural appropriation, let's just change the definition of what this clothing means, that it represents a general cause. So that would be all the issues of cultural appropriation that they talked about in the Floyd era, we can kind of go back and say, let's just identify them with a cause and then you don't get hit with the cultural appropriation issue. So in other words, you can't redefine terms to fit the narrative. That is part of hypocrisy in definition. But that goes along with saying that that's how the vocal minority is seen in both, you know, in public and in the media. Now, another thing that we mentioned is that there is a minority in both political parties. And I mentioned this earlier. Republicans have it on the right. You have very far right-leaning people, and the Democrats have it on the left. And it's generally these are the wings of the party that somehow are guiding both parties, more on the Republican side than the Democrat side. But, you know, nonetheless, they are guiding both parties. And it used to be like, what is the purpose of far right or far left positions in your political party? And I used to go with a simple analogy. And it's a plane analogy, an airplane. So generally, you look at an airplane, it has two wings. And the two wings are necessary for the plane to fly, to give it the lift. However, where do most people sit? They sit in the center. The pilot sits in the center, the cockpit. All the passengers sit in the fuselage, which is the center. So the center is the critical part of where everyone occupies. They occupy the middle. They occupy the moderate. They're not on the wings. If these people were on the wings and you govern by the wings, we wouldn't have any governing at all, and the plane wouldn't be flying. So the simple analogy is the wings are important for a plane to fly. Their wings are important for conversation, to mold policy and give policy a conscience a little bit. But again, when it has to fly, everyone has to be in the middle. You have to have the moderates. So I do believe that the silent majority sits in the plane, sits in the fuselage. And it's something that we have to really look at this election cycle, because this election cycle is, first of all, it's a repeat. You have the same two people running again, a little bit older and a little bit more geriatric in their approach, but you have the same people running the same time. Now, they both represent wings of the party. It's just a question on how moderate or non-moderate they are. For instance, you get Donald Trump, and Donald Trump generally wants a very strong presidency with a lot of power and a lot of executive power. He wants broad authority and control. And there's something to be said by that, that the best form of government is a benevolent dictator. The problem is we can always find dictators. We can never find one that's truly benevolent. On the other side, you have Joe Biden, who really wants a one-party rule. He wants the Democratic Party to be in control in every election cycle, from the national election down to the local elections. He believes in kind of a one-party rule, and he rules by executive order to kind of guarantee that. A lot of people feel that that's why the borders are open, is to fill the country with migrants who give the power to vote, and it keeps them in power. I don't know if that's a viable conspiracy theory or a viable theory in general, but, you know, we'll leave that open. So either side becomes kind of like a quasi-dictatorship. Both parties have their constituencies, but is it the moderate middle really being heard by either party? And it's tough to say right now, because we've been through one Trump presidency. We're experiencing another presidency now with Biden. And it's a question whether we're really seeing the moderate positions being approached or approved. And it's funny, at any time that we would have a third party, I would think now would be it. We had the Ross Perot third party push. It was generally a one-cycle rule. But any time we need a third party, it's basically now. But both parties are actively trying to quash a third party bid. Kennedy's running for a third party. The Biden team is trying to really convince him not to run until they found out that he's probably going to draw more Trump supporters than Biden supporters to vote for him. And of course, now Trump's now bad-mouthing Kennedy, who is running. Now, whether you agree with Kennedy's positions or his conspiracy theories or some of his out there theories, he is a third party. And the problem is that most people do not, of each political party, do not want a third party to run, because they feel that it takes votes away from them. And if they do take votes away from them, you put the other party in power. So again, that's a little bit of an issue. We had a third party concept called the No Labels Party. And this is a party that actually went out and tried to get on the ballots of some of the states. And they were trying to get a national candidate. And they were trying to get the West Virginia senator, who decided not to run on the Republican side, on the Democratic side, as Manchin, to run. And he declined it. He would have probably been he's a very moderate. He generally votes moderate. He's not generally coming from West Virginia. You have to kind of keep the environmental context a little lower, because you have coal being generated in West Virginia. So he was a perfect candidate. However, he decided not to run under the No Labels brand. And this is something that's really disconcerting, that as far as the No Labels go, they had all these people looking to run, and not one of them decided to run. Because it seems that the allegiance to the party is greater than the allegiance to the country. So for third parties who can't gain a foothold in this any election, there's no momentum for them. If there is a third party, it's a one-off, it's an outlier, and it's difficult to kind of get people in there. So real brief before we end today, what would be the requirements of a third party? Number one is staying power and willing to run on all levels of government, local and national and state level, right? And maybe start at the local level to become in there. You have to have the entry point of local politics. You have to have grassroots, and you have to have a commitment really to run and not worry about alienating the other parties in case they should win, that you won't have a job in that type of election. So again, can the silent majority participate? Absolutely. They have to get busy. In the coming weeks, we're going to discuss how this works, how you can be a part of it. We actually have products that have silent majority on them, hats and stuff like that we're going to promote. But we're going to start the grassroots campaign to get the silent majority to voice themselves, to act themselves, and really become a force in politics today. So again, I'm Steve Carvelli for Street and Curb. Join us for the adventure. Join us for the ride, because we're just beginning, and this is the start of something big and something that will get bigger as we get closer to the election, too. Join us next week. We'll see you then.